Congregation, let's turn our Bibles again to Hebrews chapter 13. And I would like to direct our attention to verses 5 and 6. Hebrews 13, verses 5 and 6. There we read, "Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, 'I will never leave you nor forsake you.' So we may boldly say, 'The Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me?'" In 1971, that's 50 years ago, President Nixon, he declared war on cancer. And in that declaration, he launched what has become a global effort to find a cure for cancer. And over the past 50 years, based on the numbers from the National Cancer Institute, over $100 billion has been spent in the United States alone on cancer research. $100 billion just on research to find a cure for cancer. That number is increasing by about $6 billion a year. And so there is this all-out war on this terrible disease. Now we thank God for the time and energy and money that's been spent on finding a cure for cancer. We are thankful for the steps that have been taken, no matter how small they may seem to be. And yet, this afternoon, I want to draw attention to another illness that is even far more deadly, far more widespread, and much more difficult to cure. And one that the American government is not spending any money on to get rid of, but instead our culture is spending money to promote. And that is the disease of covetousness. The disease of covetousness. And given the amount of effort we spend on trying to get rid of cancer, how much effort are we spending personally on getting rid of this disease? This covetous spirit. All of us are infected by covetousness. What Jeremiah said of Israel is true of all of humanity. Jeremiah 6:13 says, "From the least of them, even to the greatest of them, everyone is given to covetousness." And this is a spiritual disease. It's a disease that's power, it can't be broken by physical remedies. Jesus in Mark chapter 7, verse 22 states that covetousness springs forth from the impure heart. It gushes forth from the heart. And left untreated, this disease will land us in hell. Ephesians 5, verse 5, "For this you know, that no fornicator, unclean person, nor covetous man who is an idolater has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God." And so what a deadly disease this is, this covetousness, and how it thrives in the materialism of the West. And so then, how necessary it is for us to deal decisively with this disease in our own lives, and that can only be done by the Spirit's power. And so may that be the outcome of our message this afternoon. Our title is "The Cure for Covetousness." The cure for covetousness. First, covetous. Second, content. And third, confident. And here we want to diagnose this sin and understand its source in the first point before moving to the cure in the second two points. And so the cure for covetousness, and first of all, covetous. Look again with me, if you have a Bible in front of you, at verse 5. There we read, "Let your conduct be without covetousness." This is the standard that we are called to live by. Our lives, that's another word for conduct, are to be free from coveting. Let your lives, let your conduct be without covetousness. And so this is a command for us, Yes, it's a command in the Old Testament. God's law says you shall not covet. But the New Testament equally affirms that as a good and right command, as part of the law of God. It's still our standard today. And so this means that at every point of our life, God's law, this standard is addressing us. It's coming to us. You shall not covet. When we wake up in the morning and we're tempted to lay in bed and to desire someone else's life, God says, you shall not covet. When we go to the table in the morning and we grumble to our parents that there's nothing good to eat, God says, do not covet. When we scroll through social media desiring what others have, God says, you shall not covet. When we're with friends who seem to be more gifted, more attractive, or maybe have more things, God says, do not covet. When we go to our friend's house and we see their newly renovated kitchen or their new car, God says, do not covet. When we see someone's health or someone's picture-perfect family, God's there with his law saying, do not covet. This is his command every minute of every day. Our Creator is here declaring his will for our lives. This is my will. Do not covet. And I wonder then, does anyone listening still think they are without sin? Who here or who listening can say that coveting is something that they don't struggle with? If we're honest, all of us struggle with this sin. Coveting is something that is so natural to our sinful hearts. It's like biking down a hill. It's easy, and in fact, it's actually hard to stop. That's what coveting is like to the human heart. Well, what is this sin? What is the sin of covetousness? That's what we're looking at in the first place. Under the first point, we want to see the sin. What is coveting? Well, simply put, it's desiring something that you don't have to the point that you're not satisfied until you get it. Desiring something that you don't have and to the point that you're not satisfied, you can't rest until you get it. It's a craven desire to fill a void. It's a thirst for something, an unquenchable thirst for something, a thirst that can't be satisfied. It's a lusting after something. It's that addiction feeling. I need this. I won't be happy until I have this. That's what coveting is. And so notice, it's really all about desires. Our catechism brings this out because the Bible brings this out. Deuteronomy 5, the other place where the law is recorded in the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 5 verse 21 emphasizes this. There we read, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, and you shall not desire your neighbor's house. And so notice how covet and desire are parallel to one another. This coveting, it's about our inner desires, our inner appetites. What are you hungry for? What is it that you think will satisfy? Well, the fact that it's about our desires, it reminds us that all 10 of the commands are really spiritual commands. God is never just interested in the external obedience. He's always after the heart. And so each command is always one that cuts to the very core, that's a spiritual command, that gets to the very root. All of these commands are about our thoughts, our motives, and how they're meant to be conformed to God as well. Now, it's not that all desires are wrong. God does not say that all desires are wrong. We are to desire some things. We are to desire God. That's what he calls us to in Psalm 34. We must desire him, delight in him. We're to desire God's ways. We're to desire his kingdom. We're even to desire the enjoyment of God's gifts. That's a good desire. It's a good desire to want to work. Work is a good thing, and it's good to have that desire. It's good to desire to want a family, for example. That's a good, healthy desire. God is not saying all desires are sinful. He's not squelching desires. So what is God saying? Well, here God is forbidding us from desiring anything beside himself that we think will give us ultimate meaning, ultimate joy, or ultimate satisfaction. It's about what we desire most. That's what God is getting at. When we covet, we are saying, I need something besides God to give me joy. I see my neighbor has something, I need that to make me satisfied. And it's different for everyone. We all have something that we covet, or many things that we covet, but it's different for each of us. What is it for you? Just think about your life. Think about this week. What was it for you this week that was declaring and whispering to your heart, you need this in order to live well? You must have this in your life. You can't live without it. Life is meaningless without this thing, without this person, without this recognition. What is it? Well, whatever it is, that is the thing that we are coveting. So that's the sin of covetousness, and that takes us to the second thing we want to see about covetousness under the first point, and that is the source of this sin. If we're going to uproot this sin, rather than just pull at the top of the weeds of the top of the weed and pull off the leaves, we need to understand its source. We need to dig deeper to its very root. And the Bible shows us that there are actually two sins that live beneath the sin of coveting. Two sins that breed coveting and the covetous spirit. And if these two sins don't get dealt with, then we are wasting our time as we pull at this weed. And so what is the source of coveting? Well, as I said, when we covet, we are saying, I need something besides God in order to give me satisfaction or joy, and that is idolatry. And so one of the sources of coveting is idolatry. This is what Paul, listen to what Paul says in Ephesians 5. I already read this. Ephesians 5, verse 5, the covetous man is an idolater. That's what Paul says. The covetous man is an idolater. Every time we covet, we are saying, God is not enough. I need something else. I need another God. I need something besides God. And so idolatry is investing into something, some created thing, maybe even a good thing, only that which God can give. It's over-inflating the creature. It's making a God out of something that God has created. And how our hearts love to do this. We let our idols repeatedly overpromise and underdeliver to us. Repeatedly. Our idols, let's say money, for example, promises us happiness. That's the promise that money gives. We go and we get the money and we feel the tinge of delight, but there's no real lasting satisfaction or happiness there. And yet we believe the lie again the next day. And we get a little more money, maybe. And we get a little more of a tinge of excitement. And so this goes on. Yet we're never satisfied. And so idolatry, it's a source of coveting. But the other is unbelief. That's the other source, unbelief. And notice how these two sins are so connected. If idolatry is lifting up a creature into God's spot, then unbelief is taking God, it's lowering God from his throne. And when these two go together, the exchange is complete. Then we have exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator who's blessed forevermore, as Paul says in Romans 1. And so here is how unbelief is involved. God has declared to us that he is our provider. He has said he will take care of our needs. But when we covet, we are saying that God is not doing a good job. He is not providing. Lord, you said you would provide, and you aren't providing enough. That's what unbelief says. And so we need more. We want more. And that then is the sin of coveting. Unbelief gives birth to this covetous spirit. And this coveting then is driven by our doubts about God. And underlying all of this, stoking the fire of our doubts, are our own fears. Will God provide? Will he actually take care of me? Will he actually be faithful to provide everything that I need? And as the fears grow, so do our doubts in God, and we convince ourselves that yes, we actually do need to take care of ourselves. God won't do it for us, and so we have to take this into our own hands. And we start to covet. Maybe we start hating our neighbor in the process. I want what they have, and I don't care if they have it, I need it. We look with envy. And so we're seeing then that covetousness, it really is, it also gives root to many other transgressions of God's law. If I desire something badly enough, then I will do whatever it takes to get it. And so that leads to other sin. You see this repeatedly in Scripture. Gehazi, he desired Naaman's gifts, and so he lied to get them. His desire led to lying. David, he desired Bathsheba, and so he committed adultery. He took this other man's wife, and then he murdered to cover it up. Judas, he desired money. He was a thief. He desired the money. He committed the act of theft, but then he also went and betrayed Christ himself. So do you see how serious this sin is? This is why God says, let your conduct be without covetousness. Live completely free of it. It's to have no room in your life. It is destructive. It's dishonoring to me, and it's destructive to your neighbor and to yourself. You shall not covet. Maybe if you're thinking, if I just knew your situation or your needs, then I would understand a little more why we ought to be able to look with desire at things that we don't have. But that's really why we read Hebrews 10 and Hebrews 12. Because that's where we get a sense of the context. In Hebrews chapter 10, we read about how the Hebrew Christians were dealing with persecution. In fact, in the past, they had their property had been plundered. They were losing items. They were losing property for the sake of Christ. They had let goods and kindreds go. And they were doing so gladly for Christ's cause. But then chapter 12 has told us that they have started to despise God's discipline. That they started off well, but now they were beginning to want God's things more than God's holiness in their lives. They wanted God's gifts more than God's good purposes that was being worked out through affliction. And so the author to the Hebrews recognizes that they're tempted to covet. And he addresses that in their need, in their lack, in their suffering. He says, be careful. Be careful. Let your conduct be done without covetousness. Well, how are we doing with the spiritual disease? Is your heart sick? Are you covetous? What's the antidote for this? What's the cure? That's where we want to look in the second point. The second word is content. Covetous, now content. Notice verse 5 continues. Be content with such things as you have. That's the command. That's God's command. Be content with such things as you have. Whatever you have, be content. And so what a difference contentment is from the covetous spirit. What a difference. It's the polar opposite. And the Puritan Jeremiah Burroughs, he titled his classic book on contentment, he titled it The Rare Jewel of Christian Contentment. And he's exactly right. What a jewel this contentment is, and how rare it is, even among Christians, sadly. Well, what is contentment? Jeremiah Burroughs, he writes, Christian contentment is that sweet inward, quiet, gracious frame of spirit, which freely submits to and delights in God's wise and fatherly disposal in every condition. That's a beautiful definition. Christian contentment is that sweet, inward, quiet, gracious frame of mind which freely submits to and delights in God's wise and fatherly disposal in every condition. And so it's that peaceful frame of mind. It's that heart that's at rest in a life that's filled with many needs and many turmoils and many troubles. There in the midst of that is the heart at rest. Now we might think that this rest is something that's passive. We just let ourselves rest. It just kind of happens to us. But that's not the case at all with contentment. No, this is an active resting. In fact, this word, it carries the idea of strength. It takes strength to have this contentment. It means the ability, the power, the capacity to face the many, many real cares of life with peace. And so God is saying this is what's needed. We need to move from the covetous mind frame to the content one. Well, how can we do that? How can we do that? I hope you're asking that question. This seems so impossible. What's the cure for this? How can we cure the covetousness of our heart? How can we move from the love for money, the endless craving after more things, the unquenchable desire to have what we don't have? How can we move from that to a rest and a peace? Well, the answer is to know and to love God. That's the answer. That's how it's done. We need to know and to love God. It's impossible to find contentment apart from God. The triune God, he is the only source of true peace and the only source of true rest. This is what Augustine stated. He said that we all have this God-sized hole in our hearts and that we are restless until we find our rest in him. And that is exactly the teaching of our text. Notice what our text says. We find this what seems to be this impossible command. Be content with such things as you have, and you ask, how can I? And then the author goes on and he says, for he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And so the author is saying, here's the answer. Here's the cure to covetousness. Here's the answer to contentment. God has promised, I will never leave you. And so here's the point that we're making. This contentment is elusive. It forever escapes us until we rest in the triune God. If we are seeking to be content or happy or satisfied or at peace or at rest somewhere other than the triune God, then we are enslaving ourselves to a life of covetousness, to a life of discontentment, to a bitter cycle of constant envy. The only way to be content is to have God. And so we need to look at this promise here a little more closely. He himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Now, this sentence is emphatic in the Greek, and the first way we see the emphasis of the sentence is notice the emphasis on God. The author doesn't just say he has said, but he says he himself has said. He's heaping up the pronouns. He himself, the author wants us to think about who is speaking. Who is the he? Who is the one who is making this promise? That makes all the difference. Well, it's God. It's the triune God. It's the God who satisfies. That's what makes the difference when we come to the promise. And what a precious promise this is. Notice what God says. For he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Now, this is the promise that God gave to Joshua in Deuteronomy 31 and again in Joshua chapter 1 as he was on the border of Canaan. There was Joshua. He was about to undergo what would seem like an impossible mission. He was going against all odds. He had everything against him, but the one thing that made his mission possible, the one thing that was to give him peace and rest so that he could go forward in faithfulness, was this promise. God said to him, "I will never leave you nor forsake you." Now, in the English, there are two negatives. You hear that. I will never leave you nor forsake you. So two negative statements. But in the Greek, there are actually five negatives. The author is literally piling up them up. So we could literally translate this as, I will never, never leave you. And no, I will never, never forsake you. That's what God said to Joshua. And that's what God is saying to all of his people today. And see, the idea is that God, he hates the thought. He hates it when his people think that he has abandoned them. God hates that. Because that is a lie from Satan. That thought, that when God's people think, God has abandoned me. God will not provide for me, so I must covet. I must take care of myself. God hates it when we think that, because he is our jealous husband who has said, I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. And so here in our promise, it's as if God is sitting down his bride. He's sitting down his people on next to him, and he's looking his bride in the eye, and he's saying, I will absolutely never forsake you. This is my promise in the Old Testament. This is my promise in the New Testament. And so trust me. My dear wife, how can you think such thoughts? It goes against everything I've ever said to you, everything I've ever done. It goes against every aspect of my character. That's what God is saying to his people in this promise. I will never, never leave you. No, I will never, never forsake you. And so God is here promising that the true believer, that his people have his gracious presence always with them. And so if we go back to our question, how is the Christian to be more and more cured from coveting and experience more contentment in their lives? Well, we know that this is the Spirit's work. The Spirit must give and he must increase this contentment. But the Spirit uses means, and the one means that the Spirit uses are his promises. And so how do we grow in contentment? It's by living by the promises, living according to the promises of God. Just listen to John Calvin, the spiritual doctor, as he prescribes the treatment to us. He writes, when the apostle is seeking to cure us of the disease of covetousness, he wisely calls our attention to God's promises, in which God testifies that he will ever be present with us. And so Calvin goes on and says that faith alone, Spirit-worked faith alone, is that which can quiet our minds. It's faith alone that enables us to say with the psalmist in Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. I have no lack. I need nothing. I am at rest in his care. And so this is the secret to contentment. It's about living by the promises. But it's also about prizing. It's about valuing things appropriately. Isn't this true that so often we go wrong because we evaluate things wrongly? We place a certain value upon some of the things in our life, whether it's comfort or whether it's our reputation or whether it's whatever it is that you're tempted to value above all else. We value those things so highly, and yet we don't value God or his presence nearly highly enough. But contentment is about correcting that. It's about re-evaluating things by the Spirit's help. It's about prizing God first. It's about thinking of him as the one who alone can satisfy. It's recognizing what is necessary and what is just nice but unnecessary. That's the secret to contentment. Yes, peace with God, that is necessary. That's something I need. But a perfect family, That would be nice, but it's not necessary. I can be content in God without a perfect family. The new birth, that is necessary. To have the Spirit, His work in my life, that is necessary. But a new house, or a new car, or a new bike, or a new boat, that's not necessary. It would be nice, but I could live without it. Christ's saving presence, that is necessary. But this promotion at work, it's not. This is the secret to contentment. When the Spirit helps us to evaluate things rightly, to see that God, He is necessary, and that His work is our true need. It's when we get this disordered that we fall into the sin of coveting. And so what are our needs? Well, Paul writes in 1 Timothy 6, verse 6, "Godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain that we carry nothing out. And having food and clothing, with these things we shall be content." Do you hear that? Those are our true needs. We can be so disillusioned in the West. This is true of all of us. We can think certain things are needs when they are just really desires. Do we have food in our fridge? Do we have clothing in our closet? Then God is saying we should be content. But Pastor, what about our dreams? What about our hopes? What about our future? What about this? I know. My sinful heart says the same thing. But God says, be content with what you have. Be content in me, and I will provide. The only thing necessary in our life is to have Him, to have God with us, and to have God for us. And so we've seen covetous. We've seen the second word, content. But now finally, in the last place, we want to look at this word, confident. Confident. Now maybe you wonder, how does this word fit in? I understand how content, being content, is the opposite of covetous, but confident, where does that come from? Well, it fits in beautifully, and you see it in our text. It comes from verse 6. Notice verse 6 says, so there's a connection to what came before. So we may boldly say, we may confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? This is the response of faith. The promise has come to the child of God. I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. And here now is the response. This is the response God is looking for. If our covetousness is to be cured, and if we are to live content, then we must get to this third point as well. We must confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? And so more and more, by the Spirit's help, God's children learn to respond to that promise of God's presence in faith, and by claiming that faith. And so the author to the Hebrews, he's showing us how God's child is to claim that contentment and to lean into it and to remain in that contented frame of mind. How do we carry on in this with this contented mind? How do we stay away from coveting? Well, here's the answer. It's to confidently embrace the promise of God. It's to give your amen to God's promise, to His gracious word, to say, yes, Lord, you are right. You are my helper. And so what shall I fear? Now, for the child of God, some days there is a real feeling of the Lord's presence. And these words are an easy expression of our heart. The Lord is my helper. That just comes bubbling out on some days. Some days we're able to reflect upon the Lord's goodness and joy. He will never leave me. He will never forsake me. We seem to have that confidence. We feel carried along by the promises. It's like we're sailing along on a bright sunny day. The wind is in our sails. And so we say, the Lord is my helper. Those are some days in the Christian's life. But not every day looks like that. It's not always like that for God's people. In fact, other days, there is this fight of faith, a struggle. Yes, we must claim the promise. Some days we're rejoicing in them, but on the days when there's a struggle, when there's no feeling of the Lord's nearness, of the Lord's presence, then we still need to confidently claim this promise just as much. But we do so to a different end. On those days, we are wrestling with the evil thoughts that the Lord has abandoned me. We are wrestling with our covetous mind. It's on those days that this promise end becomes our fighting words. The Lord is my helper. We don't feel it, but we're fighting tooth and nail to believe it. We're declaring it to ourselves. We boldly say, the Lord is my helper. We're preaching it to ourselves. We're trying to get our soul to embrace this truth. The storm, it's swirling all around us, but the Spirit, he presents this promise to us. And so we're casting our anchor upon it. The Lord is my helper. That's how we get through those dark days and back into the frame of mind of peace. Again, go back to Psalm 23. Yes, there are days when it seems the shepherd leads us to places of rest, but then there are the dark valleys. And the only thing that keeps us in the dark valley is that he is with me. He will never leave me. He will never forsake me. And so how we need this Spirit-worked confidence of faith. Sadly, the Christian often lives far beneath this. Sadly, the Christian is often not content. The Christian, the one who has God as their God, is often not satisfied with God. Isn't that horrible, child of God? Doesn't that make you grieve as you think about your own discontentment in the Lord? Well, our catechism speaks to this. It says, even the holiest of men make but small beginnings in the walk of holiness, and yet we are resolved not only to keep some, but all of the commandments of God. And so our small beginnings aren't excuses to sit back and let sin reign in us. Absolutely not. It's in those days that we learn to fight again with these promises. We learn to be confident in the Lord. He is my helper. Well, I wonder, do you have warrant to say that? Can you say that? He is my helper. The Lord is on my side. God with his almighty power and strength, he is for me. Can you say that? That makes all the difference. All the difference in the world. Naturally, we can't say that, but if we've experienced his grace, then we must say that. Maybe you say, well, how can I know? How do I know if I've experienced this grace in my life? Again, our catechism, it helps us. And there's really three questions I have for you, and they all focus on relationship. What's your relationship to sin? Is there a hatred for sin? Do you see your sin, and does that cause you to cry out to God for mercy? Do you see not only your evil thoughts and words and deeds, but do you see your indwelling sin, sin that lives so deep inside? Do you hate it and confess it and seek to turn from it? Do you have this new relationship with sin? That's a mark of the Spirit's work. What's your relationship to Christ? Is there love for Christ? The question isn't, are you satisfied with your levels of love for Christ? But is there love for Christ at all? Are you drawn to him? Do you want him in your life? Yes, you want his forgiveness, but do you also want his presence? Do you want his fellowship? Do you want his friendship? Do you want his lordship? That's a sign of the Spirit's work. This new relationship to Christ, but also this new relationship to Christ's law. Is there a sincere resolution, a sincere desire to begin to live not only according to some, but to all of his commands? Not that you accomplish this, not that you do this, but is there a striving after this? A striving after holiness, without which we cannot see God? Is there some killing of covetousness in our lives, and some putting on of contentment? My friend, if there are these three things, if you have these new relationships, that's only because the Spirit has worked. In ourselves, we wouldn't have these things, not even a little bit. And so if you see it there, it's because of the Spirit. And so this promise is for you. You can confidently say, "The Lord is my helper." And this afternoon, God is calling you to embrace that. He's calling you to claim that. If you haven't claimed that before, maybe you've lacked assurance before. I can't go there. That sounds presumptuous. It's not presumptuous if God is giving you every right to claim this promise. No, that is faith. That is trust. In fact, it's unbelief not to. It's disobedience not to. And so just like Joshua, we need to claim these promises. We need to step forward in confidence because we're on a journey to the promised land. Notice verse 14. We have no continuing city, but we seek the one to come. If we remember that, it's a lot easier to be content in life. The things that we have here today won't stay with us forever. And what is coming is a far greater inheritance. But what is our marching song? What is the song that carries us home with contentment in our hearts? Well, it's the words of verse 6. The Lord, He is my helper. What shall I fear? Amen.